by the and the right of the biological parent, and yet the court in case after case is unable to hear the evidence. There is no way the stepmother can come into court and present her case. There is no known way that the long-term foster parent or the relative. We were caught by surprise believing that there was no opposition to the bill, and so we did not bring many witnesses, but we do have one or two families here. The hearing in House Judiciary was much more formal. The point of the amended version of this bill is simply that it took out all reference or avoided all temptation to tell the court what it does with the evidence after it gets it. This has nothing to do with the substantive law. This is entirely the need of the courts, and Judge Norblad particularly was very strong in his testimony, the need of the court to hear all sides. Now, the bill did pass House Judiciary unanimously and House Floor 57-0. Nevertheless, Children's Services has had some second thoughts, and we are willing to accommodate them because we realize they have experience in this beyond anyone. I will let Mr. Armas explain that, but the basic position is that this is a procedural act in order to make it possible for the courts to fulfill their mandate. Now, the only real objection that was brought up before, and it's a real one, was that this might gum up the works by allowing a lot of interveners in a case. However, pretty wide checking with the juvenile and domestic relations courts came to the conclusion that this was not going to be true. In these heartrending cases where, for instance, a stepmother has raised a child for 12 years and then her husband dies, for example, and she has no standing in court to go in and ask to continue the relationship. The desperate efforts of the mother or stepmother to get into court end up enriching the lawyers with motions and petitions and all of this, which eat up a lot of court time. But there's a more ominous side to it. The child who, by reason of the fact that the court could not hear all the evidence, goes to the wrong place, and we do have a family here of Mrs. Darger who will explain the terrible results thereof, the child who is placed in the wrong home ends up before the court again a year or so later as a runaway or a delinquent.
Well, so that mother could adopt the child.
Pardon?
The stepmother in your situation could adopt the child.
Normally she cannot.
Why not?
Normally she has to get in line with everybody else. It's a long, slow process. In the interim, very often, this bond is disrupted and the child is moved somewhere else. You change the case just a little bit to accommodate the case actually here ready to testify. It was a divorce after 12 years of marriage, I believe. This procedural amendment applies both to domestic relations and juvenile court. At this moment, I would like to yield to Mr. Armas, who would explain the CSD's concerns and the amendments we would propose to accommodate them.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jess Armas. I'm Assistant Minister of Children's Services Division. We have no problem with the bill if it only applied to domestic relations. When it applies to, except for the adoptions part of it, when it applies to other parts, we do have. But our primary concern is with adoptions, that when a child is placed in adoption and that family is fully expecting, and also the child is fully expecting to stay into that home, that this would open a process by which individuals could come in and try to substantiate they should have the child. Now, with talking about generally cases where we've already gone through the process of looking for anyone that's had a meaningful relationship with a child. Our primary purpose is to try to put them with what is called a psychological parent anyway. And in 33% of the cases, they are foster or relative adopt placements. What we want to be sure is that we don't have a succession of individuals coming in and intervening in the process. The other thing that we have concerns about is just the whole adoption process. If we open it up to where an adoptive family never knows until it is finalized, which we don't finalize an adoption generally until 6 months to a year later, and in some cases where we have only a partially free child, that is, only one parent has either through court action or others reasons we've been given the termination so that we can proceed for adoption, we will oftentimes place in a family, a foster family, which we call a foster adopt family, saying, we intend to go ahead with adoption with you. We want you to bond the child. We're not sure how long it's going to take for any of the other termination to take place, and we will proceed with you. That sometimes takes considerable length of time. So what we're concerned about is in the adoption process in particular, and this is what Father Phillips has mentioned, we will take adoption out of the bill so that it has no reference to adoption. That would satisfy a number of our concerns regarding the bill. The other part is a definition of who that psychological parent is. Coming right out of the research that was done, there will be a new section added, and I don't know the exact wording, but there will be a section 4 added, which is not on here, that further defines that that's a 2-year continuous relationship where they've received the emotional support and also the physical caring, so that it isn't just somebody that can walk in and say, I've had a 2-year relationship with a child that's been meaningful, the child wants to live with me, or the child, I know the child and been around for 2 years. This further defines it so that it makes sure that we're really talking about people who have had more than just a meaning in the child's life, have actually functioned as the child's parent, and that would be very disruptive to the child not to have that relationship at least considered, but more important, to have it continued. So those are two things that take care of a lot of the concerns that we have about the bill.
Mike Greenfield from the juvenile court must be a slow typist. He ran down the hall, but he has the book. But we would take the definition of parent-child relationship right out of Solnitz and Freud, which says essentially that there's been a continuous relationship which involves day-to-day contact, psychological nurturing, and supplying the child's physical needs. This would avoid some aunt or uncle who perhaps only had the child at Christmas and Easter or weekends from coming in. We are all of us interested in keeping the court process simple and not too many interveners. But there are tragic cases right now, very tragic cases, where the child's best interest is not served because the court can't hear the evidence.
Well, does anyone perceive that this bill in its amended form would actually preclude the step-parent from petitioning for adoption of the child?
It would not preclude the petition in due form. Again, we are not talking here substantive law. Insofar as the substantive law stands, anyone can petition for adoption. That would not change. We're only here talking about the placement of a child, which has to change right now.
Yeah. got it. Any questions, counsel? All right, thank you. Now,
one thing I should add, Mr. Chairman, we haven't done a fiscal impact on this, and I don't know if there will be one on it, but...
Mr. Chairman, if I may add to that, I don't know how formal he means by fiscal impact, but Justice got into this bill very recently. The original documents filed with the House have a statement on them from CSD that the fiscal impact is unknown and probably will be neutral.
Okay. Now, I guess Mr. Armas's appearance takes care of Herb Hansen and Jim Wheeler. Does it?
Senator, by almost.
Almost?
I must.
Maybe you don't agree with CSD, so you better come up now.
I'm Herb Hansen from Portland. I'm Director of Professional Services at Albertina Kerr Centers for Children.
And I'm Jim Wheeler, and I'm Associate State Director with Boys and Girls Aid Society.
And basically, we do agree with CSD. There may be some areas here that may or may not be resolved by this thing because we haven't seen it and don't know really what it's going to say. We were concerned about three things. One of them is that generally the adoption proceedings, as Mr. Armas said, in a situation occur some way down the line from the time the decision is made for the child to be placed in the family. And as the bill was originally written, it looked as though the adoption proceedings were a good point of intervention, and it would be hard to give the family the security it would seem that they often need, particularly in the placement of older kids, but also in the placement of newborn children. So if adoption is in some way excluded from this process, we would certainly give it a strong support. Another aspect is the question of visitation, as it was written here. We didn't really understand whether that could extend to a mandatory program of visiting on the part of other people in an adoptive situation. We feel that this is very, very difficult. There is a movement in the community to promote what is called open adoption. There are people active in Eugene and elsewhere about it, in which the birth parents do maintain a contact with the adoptive parents. But in our experience, that's a very new thing that we tested, and it would tend, we feel, to kind of chill the potential involvement of the adoptive family or perhaps their willingness to take the child if a mandatory visitation program were established by this law. The other aspect that concerned us was that it wasn't clear in the material here whether or not the existence of a two-year relationship, or as it may be redefined, was the only status that would give a person the right to intervene. And what we see sometimes is after careful work with a young mother who is about to give birth, she may make a decision to relinquish it.
Go ahead, Dave. Mr. Chairman, many privately funded construction contract documents require the prime contractor to keep the project free from all liens that may be claimed. While there's nothing fundamentally wrong in this concept, hardships that have been extreme have been imposed upon the contractor when that contractor has been notified that a construction lien claim may be made. Significantly, notices of the right to claim a lien are filed with the owner of the property, but there is no similar requirement that such notices be filed with the prime contractor. The purpose of the proposed amendment to House Bill 2334 is to say that such provisions in privately funded construction projects are enforceable only if the contractor is given, in a timely fashion, a copy of the notice that has been filed with the owner. The contractor will then have the opportunity to make certain that all monies due a potential lien claimant will be paid and the possibility of the prime contractor being subjected to a claim that the prime contractor had no knowledge of will be averted. The amendment will not in any way jeopardize the rights of a claimant, and it should ensure that potential claimants will be satisfied much more rapidly than before enactment of this provision. Now, Mr. Chairman, I've discussed this potential amendment with Mr. Bill Alexander, who's a major supplier of materials to commercial improvement projects. He somewhat avidly supports the concept of this amendment because he recognizes that that means that the supplier of materials of the construction project is going to get paid much sooner than under the present conditions. I've discussed it with Mr. John Gervais, who was up here earlier. He has indicated support. We're suggesting this amendment fully with the permission of the requesters at Hospital 2334, the Oregon Bankers Association. And I did discuss this amendment with Mr. Marvin Hall, who's the business agent, I believe, of the Carpenters Union. Mr. Hall indicated that they are also supportive. I happened to talk to him, Mr. Chairman, because the five of the six craft unions that we negotiate labor union agreements with happened to be meeting today with our contractors. As a matter of fact, at this very moment, or at least earlier this afternoon, and we asked them to endorse or support this proposal, and Mr. Hall came to the telephone and discussed it with me. He suggested that perhaps the wording ought to be even stronger, requiring the lien claimant to file dual notices, one with the owner of the property and one with the prime contractor on the project. I told him I didn't want to suggest that because that means the claimant is going to have to file two notices where they're now required to file one notice of the right to claim a lien, and he conceded that that might be that might cause more controversy and more problems. This seems to satisfy a problem that we have. The amendment that was prepared, Mr. Chairman, was prepared by Senator Brown for introduction at this time. One member of ours, who happens to be a constituent of Senator Brown's, contacted him regarding this this proposal, and I think Senator Brown is supportive of it.
Did you propose this over in the House?
Mr. Chairman, we did propose it to a subcommittee in the House Judiciary Committee on House Bill 2002. That was an error on my part, which I frankly admitted then and admit now. It was House Bill 2002 was a Bar Association bill, and they just frankly didn't want to have any amendments onto their bill, so we, in effect, withdrew our request. When the issue was discussed with the subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee, there was no strong opposition. Mr. Chairman, there is one more thing that I really should bring up to you to avert any possible questions. You'll notice in the drafting of our proposed amendment by Legislative Council, they did not indicate the location where this clause, if enacted, would be codified. I discussed that with Kathleen Buffet in Legislative Council because other people had raised a question saying that they did not believe that this section should be codified within the lien law statutes. Ms. Buffet indicated that she may agree with that contention, but she, in preparing the amendment, suggested that it would be better to leave the codification matter up to Legislative Council when they've had time to consider it in the absence of the pressure of the current legislature.
Okay. Thank you. Rebuttal. Do I hear, I can't tell myself whether, frankly, the people that want to, work and put this final version together have a problem with this amendment or not, so I can't even guess whether you do or not, so I'll just have to ask you. Tell us on the record who you are.
Mike Scott, again, representing the Construction Industry Committee. It's my understanding that that committee supports the bill as presently engrossed, minus the bracket which Legislative Council has found on line 32, page 2. As to the amendment, I understand what Mr. Kalinowski is talking about. I have a problem with that individually, not necessarily speaking as a member of Construction Industry Committee. And the problem with that is that there's going to be a body of law now in the state of Oregon which says your contract doesn't mean what it says it means. The plain meaning of your contract does not mean that. When someone looks down and says, the contractor agrees to indemnify the owner from any and all construction liens which are filed against the premises of the property, that contract's not going to mean that. There's going to be another body of law that says, yes, but. And the owner, if he's sophisticated enough, gone to an attorney, can locate that position, and if it's not codified in the lien law section, he's going to have to look somewhere else to find it. It's going to affect that contract provision, the plain meaning of that contract provision. And I also individually have a concern about it being codified in the construction lien section, the statutes, and that's simply because if we talk about this on the House side, is that the words owner, contractor, in other words, have specific meanings under the construction lien statute. And there's a question as to whether this bill is going to apply and take those meanings and put them in to it, because owner and contractor, as we just discussed a few minutes ago, are very specific as to what they mean. So if the owner gives the notice, what happens? Is just that owner's interest affected, or is it the other owners who didn't give the notice? Is their interest affected? There's also a question that the notice can be given, does it have to come from the owner, agent of the owner? Can it come from the mortgagee? The mortgagee might need to receive notice under ORS 87.025 and not under ORS 87.021. which is what I believe this section implies. And the question is, if notice is given to the contractor by that person, is the status of the amendment, is that substantial completion? Is that substantial compliance once the owner has notice of that, regardless of where it comes from? Now, I appreciate the fact that general contractors need to know about liens. My belief is that they can have a separate contract with the owner, with the mortgagee. It says when you receive notice of those things, you waive priority or you waive our indemnification agreement unless you give me that notice. And that can be an individual thing that can be agreed to by and between those parties.
Now, what about that, Jack? Can't the contractors include that right?
The problem with that logic, Mr. Chairman, is that the bidder or the contractor, either one, is in a position of not having any face to negotiate with. You'll notice that in our proposal that I gave you, a standard contract clause, which is in the AIA, American Institute of Architects, documents. Those are, as I say, boilerplate in a great many commercial construction projects. They are, for instance, in the contract Todd Building Company has to build the addition to the Salem Hospital right down here. The contractor is in no position to negotiate with the owner when he submits his bid based on the conditions of the contract that is being offered to him. And it makes it an impossible situation.
Okay, let's see now. Go ahead, Counselor.
Do you contemplate, I notice as this is written, there is nothing specific as to whether you are contemplating it applying to current contracts. I know that normally you can't, under the law, apply something, a new piece of legislation to a current contract. Basically, you're silent as to that, but there could be an ambiguity as to how it affected contracts that had been entered into earlier but were enforced later. What was your thought on
that? Mr. Chairman, it's not intended to affect any existing contract. We recognize that precept. If there is any concern, then perhaps wording could be inserted to ensure that. But it is not our intention to in any way affect any existing contracts.
Okay, Mr. Bollinger, did you have anything else? Do you have any position on this proposed amendment? Do you have any position?
Yes,
on
I am. Chairman, for the record, my name is Bill Bollinger, Missouri State Building Trades Council. I'm opposed to the amendment. I just would like to state that building trades is made up of some 17 crafts, and Mr. Marvin Hall and the carpenters, whom he's a member of, and all of the other building trades unions have given the indication that I lobby for them, and I generally represent their position. Now, I have spoken to Mr. Hall today, so this fact that he supports this may well be, but all of the rest of the building trades crafts had discussed 2334 at length. It's been considered and discussed, and we were very concerned with it initially, and we were very pleased that we reached the agreement we did with the A. Gross version.
Aside from the usual concerns that everybody's got in the closing days of the session, suppose this were the first week of the session, would you have a position on this amendment? Would you care, or would you oppose it?
I would oppose it.
Okay, I want to know why, on the merits, you oppose it.
Well, I think that this issue can be addressed in the contract that the general contractor and the owner have when they sit down to reach the terms they're going to have when they do the project.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
Very quickly. I think one of the largest, if not the largest, construction companies in the state of Oregon is Hoffman Construction Company, very well known. Hoffman Construction Company subcontracted some work not too long ago to a subcontractor who was signatory to a labor union agreement requiring him to pay monies to an employee benefit plan, common fringe benefit plan. Subcontractor didn't do it. The trustees of the employee benefit plan filed a notice of a lien. The owner of the project gave the lien notice to Hoffman Construction Company, and they immediately made sure that the required contributions to the employee benefit plan were paid by making out a dual check made payable to the subcontractor and the employee benefit trust plan. This averted the need for the administrators and of the employee benefit trust plan to go through and file a lien and wait, and, you know, to get their money. They were very satisfied that they got their money right away. Point is, number one, I think. That the administrators of the benefit plans that we jointly administer with the building trade unions will think that this is one of the greatest things since sliced bread, because that will happen. Secondly, believe me, the Hoffman Construction Company can't negotiate this out of a construction project. I don't know how anybody else would be able to.
Okay. Well, fine. Now, the bill as such, I don't suppose you have any particular interest one way or the other in that, do you?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2334.
361.
Okay, 2361.
Afternoon, Mr. Chair. Don Carter from the Portland firm of McEwen, Gisbold, Rankin, Stewart, and I'm testifying on behalf of the Real Estate and Land Use section of the Oregon State Bar in support of House Bill 2361. I'll just briefly summarize what the purpose of the bill is. The bill focuses on two separate issues relating to land sale contracts and the enforcement of the remedies in a land sale contract. One of the areas in which the bill is focused is in the area of a forfeiture of a land sale contract. It's one of the three typical remedies, and the present status of the law in the state of Oregon for forfeiture is somewhat muddled and unclear. It's basically a court construed remedy. There are no statutes that apply to that remedy at this time, and there have been questions as to what kind of notice is required before a forfeiture provision may be affected, whether there is an opportunity to cure, and who is entitled to notice. And the purpose of this bill is to set time periods before which the forfeiture remedy may be exercised, to require notice to be given to the purchaser and to subordinate lien holders, and to provide those same people with an opportunity to cure the default. The second major area of the bill relates to abandonment of the contract by the contract vendee and other judicial actions such as strict foreclosure or specific performance to foreclose the interest of the contract vendee. And the bill addresses that area and again requires notice to be given to certain parties and an opportunity to cure to be given to those parties before the contract vendee could abandon the interest of as contract vendee. That is important because of a recent decision by the Oregon Supreme Court in a case called the State of Brewer versus Iota Delta Chapter. It's a late 1984 or very early 1985 Oregon Supreme Court decision which held that a holder of a mortgage or an assignment of a contract vendee's interest need not be notified before the contract vendee may abandon the contract and thereby cut off the rights of that assignee or mortgagee on the contract vendee's interest. And the impact of that is, of course, that it very few lenders will lend on a contract vendee's interest, and that doesn't seem to be beneficial. They should have the same right to borrow on their equity as the grantor of a mortgage or a trust deed on the property. The bill also provides for a means of recording in the real property records an affidavit showing that the forfeiture remedy was effected and so forth. The bill is supported by the Oregon Land Title Association, the Oregon Association of Realtors, the Oregon Financial Services Association, the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar, and we've been advised by Mr. Michael Marcus, who represents some of the legal aid interests, that they support the bill as well. And there's been broad input on this bill from a broad range of sources, as my testimony has just indicated. We believe that the bill serves a beneficial purpose for sellers, buyers, and lenders on contract interests, and I urge your support of this bill. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. I thought we had a bill, a Senate bill, that did a lot of the same thing earlier. Maybe not. Okay, then, fine. Thanks a lot.
May I add one additional comment to make one point clear? The bill requires notice to purchasers, which are defined in the bill as a contract vendee or anybody who holds an interest on the contract vendee's interest. And it is the intention, it is our intention in preparing this bill that if a person who holds a lien on that interest is not notified, that the forfeiture remedy or the abandonment would still be effective as to those people who are notified, but it would not be effective as to those people who are not notified. And that's, I think that's made clear in the bill, and I just wanted to emphasize that in my testimony today.
There's only one thing obviously wrong with this bill, as far as I can see, and that is it's got the emergency clause on it. Why is that?
Mr. Chairman, that was that was added at the behest of the Oregon Financial Services Association. As originally presented, the bill only related to forfeitures. When the State of Brewer decision was handed down, the Oregon Financial Services Association felt that this created a very difficult situation for lenders on contract vendees' interests, and that it basically made it impossible to lend on that interest, and they felt that that should be remedied immediately.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, that will close the public hearing on House Bill 2361. Now, Commissioner Edwards, you've been sitting around a long time. Are you, I had this bill scheduled for last. I've got one bill before 2222 with one witness. So can you stand it a little bit longer?
No, it's fine, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We'll have a public hearing on House Bill 2258.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make this as short as I can. I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties, appearing on the House amendments to House Bill 2258, dated May 17. Mr. Chair, the gist of these amendments is to create an advisory committee on matters that affect justices and municipal courts. As far as that's concerned, we have no problem with the legislation at all. The concern that the Association of Oregon Counties has deals with sections 2 to 4 of the printed House amendments on page 2 of the amendments. What those amendments do is to require the county treasurer of every county that has a justice of the peace to create a justice of the peace fund. That fund, in turn, all the fees that are collected by the justice court would go into that account, and the monies in that account could be used only for the operating costs of the court. Sections 3 and 4 are related to that, Mr. Chair. My understanding of the purpose of these amendments, of the purpose of these three sections, is to get a handle on what the expenditures and the revenues are of Justice of the Peace Courts. The concern is that, first of all, it's not necessary to accomplish that purpose to dedicate the fund. Secondly, the language as it exists under the House amendments won't accomplish that purpose because they apply only to fees. They don't cover the other revenues that are generated by a Justice of the Peace Court. It doesn't include fines, it doesn't include bail forfeitures, it doesn't include costs. The third concern, which is the principal concern, is that the information that's intended to be collected by this language is already available in at least two sources. First of all, it's available by the audits that are submitted to the Secretary of State's office every year. Those audits require, under the Secretary of State's administrative rules, that a statement that's filed is to present as a minimum beginning balances, receipts, disbursements, refunds, and turnovers to the appropriate government official reconciled to cash on hand at the beginning and at the end of the audit period. The information is also available by virtue of the budget reports that are filed by each county and that are compiled by the Department of Revenue. After discussing this with the member of the House who offered the original language contained in sections 2, 3, and 4, he indicated to me that he would have no opposition if we appear before you today and request deletion of those three sections. You should have before you proposed amendments submitted by the Association of Oregon Counties dated June 6, 1985 to accomplish that purpose. And we urge that the committee adopt the AOC amendments of that date, Mr. Chair.
I think you've got to write a letter to the other members of this committee and explain what you're trying to do here. Were your concerns expressed to the House committee?
No, they were not, Mr. Chair. The way that developed was that we had negotiations with Representative Bellamy about other amendments, and they went on for a period of time. I thought I understood what the amendments were going to be, and so I attended another committee meeting instead of showing up at the work session. The amendments that created these three sections that concern us were submitted by another member, and I was unaware until it passed the House floor that they had been submitted.
Well, maybe you better work over the weekend and put a letter together to explain this, because I would say that on my guess is that the reaction is going to be, my God, at this point in time we have to consider these amendments, we haven't heard the testimony, and so it would be in your own best interest to
okay. Think
to do that.
Thank you.
Okay. That'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2258. Now we'll go to House Bill 2222, and Commissioner Edwards, do you want to be first, Commissioner? I've got three witnesses all in favor now.
Mr. Chairman, there's one part of the bill having to do with bingo games, and Mr. I want to talk about that, maybe I can just briefly mention bingo. You can talk about this thing, and then you can leave, and I can discuss the rest of the bill. Okay, whatever you want.
We have Tom Gilbert.
Yeah, Tom Gilbert is left. And
he's gone.
Yes, and I can probably relate to the committee what it said.
Right.
But real briefly, this bill introduced at our request was to simplify legislative requirements related to how we process paper. There are some policy issues in, but generally what we were trying to do is say, if we make changes in statutes, we can do a better job of moving the paper at less cost and give better service to the public. But the issue related to bingo is that right now nonprofit organizations that are tax exempt can operate bingo and lotto games, but they must file a notice with our office. Those notices simply sit in the file drawer. We have no authority to do anything. Every so often, either the newspapers, state police, Department of Justice, DA, and so on, will come in and want to look at those records when they're trying to investigate what might be an illegal game. So we proposed initially that those filings be transferred to the Department of Justice. The House Judiciary Committee then put in an amendment at the request of the Department of Justice to expand their authority, to have rulemaking authority over records to be maintained by bingo operations and the like, so that they could effectively deal with illegal bingo games. Tim Wood from the Department of Justice was here early to testify. The nonprofit associations, I think, do support the bill. Oregon Association of Retired Citizens was here early again, because when illegal bingo games operate, they take revenue that should be going to these charities. And let me just turn to now to the...
Okay, let's see now.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Bob Castagna with the Oregon Catholic Conference. Our concern is, as Ms. Edwards indicated, with the bingo section, and particularly on page 45 and subsection 3B, dealing with the hours during which these records are to be available for police officers and law enforcement agents. We thought that the language that came through the House had an ambiguity to it as to what hours were being referred to. And in speaking to the Department of Justice and to the Commerce Department, we have asked that the words bingo or lotto game be inserted as modifiers before the word business hours, so as to clearly indicate that those records would be available during the business hours of the games. Absent that language, a reading might be possible that at any hour that a church is open, a police officer or a law enforcement agent could walk in and request records, and that has a bit of a negative overtone to us.
Okay, is that it?
So okay. If the committee could adopt those amendments, we'd appreciate it and could be supportive of the bill.
I don't think the committee is going to be interested in amending a 56-page bill and stick that in there.
No, they haven't.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have some conflict amendments prepared by legislative counsel
Oh, you're not through. I mean, you've got more.
Oh, I just discussed this for a little bit. Yeah, it's got some other things to say. It's bingo. So there will, I think, need to be some amendments anyway because of the conflicts with a couple of other bills. If you want me to discuss what those are.
Those are on the way, or?
Yeah, Senator Fraud, the main bill is House Bill 2223, which passed a couple of hours ago. It has now been passed by both houses. Related to fees.